Welcome to another episode of the EdUp Experience Legal Podcast, Making Legal Easy. I'm your host, Deborah Solmar, and today I am thrilled to have as my guest, Michelle Schuster, the managing partner of McMurray & Schuster LLP, and she is based in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome, Michelle.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be on your podcast.
Well, I am excited to have you. You know, you and I met, I was trying to figure it out. I think we met dating ourselves, it's probably almost 10 years ago, we sat on a panel together talking about the Telephone Consumer Protection Act.
Actually, I remember it really well because you are extremely impressive and you were very stern that day. So I was thinking, wow, this is one tough lady out there. And, you know, I'm going to make sure I stay on her good side. But the other thing I remember about that is it was a Jornaya conference and they gave us socks. And I still have those Jornaya socks. So I don't know how you should take that I think about you when I see these socks.
But
it was a good event.
That's very funny because I'm thinking to myself, oh, please don't tell people what I did with those socks. So if I remember correctly, I had on a dress and black tights and high black boots. And I put the orange socks on under my boots when we sat on the panel. So they stuck out over my boots just to channel Jornaya's orange socks theme. So
this is why I remember you when I see the socks.
Well, if it's okay with you, I would love to be remembered for my orange socks. We could talk offline about the stern part, but in any event, it's been nice that we've kept in touch all of these years. And it was fun just running into you in DC a couple weeks ago or about a couple months ago. So I'm thrilled to have you. You know, I've been trying on the podcast to talk about so many different intersections of higher education, legal, regulatory, and compliance issues. And one of the big ones is definitely marketing and advertising. And I know that is absolutely in your wheelhouse. So love to spend our time together talking about that. You know, I've had the pleasure and the privilege of supporting both for-profit institutions and nonprofit institutions. And while I would say the marketing and advertising rules apply equally to them, I tend to have the experience that there's a little bit more scrutiny and a little bit more attention paid to all of those developments for the institutions that are not nonprofits. Truth, false, would you agree with that?
Well, I don't know if it's true or false, but what I do know is that the regulators have paid a lot more attention to the for-profit schools recently. And I think it's, you know, partly due to the fact that there are some for-profit schools out there that have been very good at marketing and very aggressive at marketing. And I think that as a result of that, it got the regulators' attention and it was something that they were paying attention to after from that point on. I think in particular, I think for some of the for-profit schools, they relied heavily on marketing and advertising through job websites. And I think some of the times the lead generators that were working with them weren't careful enough when they were making representations on those websites. And as a result, I think the regulators had the thought that when job seekers were going to these websites, the disclosures weren't good enough that by providing their information, they were also consenting to receive calls from for-profit schools. And so, you know, I think that that's where a crux of those types of issues came from. There is a very well-known case that the FTC came out with. Gosh, it's probably been four or so years now. And they set some standards for what they believed were the requirements to follow these unfair and deceptive acts and practices, federal and state laws, on these job websites and when engaging with third-party marketers. I think also the issue may have been, at least in my experience and having been on the involved in some of those cases with some of the marketing partners or lead generators, is that there probably wasn't enough due diligence from the for-profit universities, not with who they were working with directly, but understanding maybe what was going on underneath those direct direct relationships that they had. And I think that case was a real eye opener, just not for the, you know, education space, but for, you know, all sellers out there, that it wasn't just who they were working with, but it was oftentimes publishers that were down the line that were really causing the issues. And so I think, you know, there was a shift after that case that companies, and not just education, but, you know, especially education, they started paying way more attention to the whole ecosystem of, you know, what was happening down the line when they were getting that information. Was there the proper consent to do the right marketing follow-up that they needed to be able to do? So it's, yeah, I think as a result of that, I think a lot of people have the feeling that the attention of the regulators is a lot more on the for-profit sector.
So for those people listening who may not have sort of or eat, sleep, or breathe these things like I used to and you still do, give us like sort of an overview about how this ecosystem works. So I know, you know, I can get online and I can do a search and I can be taken to a particular school's website and I can ask for information directly from an institution. And I think what you and I are going to spend most of our time talking about is a marketing channel that happens outside of that direct connection between a visitor, a potential student, and the institution's website. Yeah. So if you could just give like a very high level overview of how else is this information being transmitted to institutions?
Yeah. And I think it's a really important thing to understand. So of course, as you just explained, you have those websites that are hosted by the institution. The institution gathers the information and they can use that information in certain ways, which we'll get to here in a moment. But then away from the direct website with the institution, you also have marketing agencies, and we'll just call them lead generators. You have lead generators that work with the institutions in ways that are much broader and spending a lot of money in targeted advertising on Facebook and through the internet, and sometimes even through email to drive traffic to the websites that this lead generator owns and operates. And the purpose of those websites is when you get the consumers to come visit those websites, they collect their information. So name, email address, phone number. And presumably, the point of having those websites is not only to get that information, but to give the ability to the for-profit institution, or maybe even the lead generator, if they're going to be the company that's reaching out directly to the consumers, to get consent from those consumers to do the type of marketing that they'd like to do. And so generally, it doesn't stop there, because those lead generators that are working with the institutions oftentimes have what are called publishers. And so the lead generators are generating their own traffic through their own websites that they control, but then they have these publishers that they work with that also have websites, presumably. Sometimes they say they have websites, but they don't. They just have lead lists that they'll provide. But these publishers also work to gather consumer information that they share with the lead generator, that the lead generator shares with the institution that they're working with. So you have this whole kind of, line of marketing that happens, and, downstream and then upstream, you have the consumer information that's getting back either to the lead generator or the institution that's making those outreaches to consumers.
And so go ahead. I was just gonna say, if you stop there, at a very high level, sounds like a good thing. You're bringing people who are looking for information, we'll talk about why we need this consent and the legalities and the legal requirements, bringing that information to institutions who are looking to provide information to students. And if we could just stop there, everything would be good, right?
It's a beautiful thing. Yes, the way it's designed to work, it is a beautiful thing. But sometimes, as you and I both know, it gets a little ugly. And it gets ugly because, you know, as the institution or seller, but we're just going to call them the institution, you have a direct relationship with your lead generator. And you can put controls, you have contracts with them, you can provide marketing requirements, guidelines, directives, whatever we want to call them, to that lead generator. And you generally have visibility into the types of things that they're doing. But when things go afoul is when that lead generator maybe isn't honest with what they're doing. And that does happen rarely, but it does happen. It causes problems. But what has often become more problematic is those publishers that are working with the lead generators. The institution has no visibility into what's going on with those publishers. And so we have seen in the enforcement actions and lawsuits that have been brought, a lot of times the publishers are what have caused the issue. And they caused the issue by not being truthful with how the information was gathered, what the consent was, maybe purchasing just lists of consumers instead of actually having those consumers go to a website and give consent. There have been manufactured what you would call, we mentioned Jornaya at the start of this. So Jornaya and Active Prospect are two companies that basically will monitor the websites, and they can provide a certificate that says that somebody with a IP address that they can provide went to this website, provided this information, and that can either be provided as a, this is the information we got, or even a recording of that website. So you can see the consumer actually filling in the information. And the purpose of those certificates was to avoid these problems of lists being manufactured and you know, that a consumer did not go to a website to provide consent. But with this Active Prospect and Jornaya tool, you could show, yes, they went, and here we have these visual playbacks, and yes, it was this IP address. And so you could match that for the consent requirements that we're going to talk about here in a minute. But unfortunately, we had some unscrupulous publishers that were even making up the Jornaya Active Prospect certificates. And so that has led to some issues. Really, they manufacture, it's hard to believe. So it's really important that if anybody out there is relying on these, that they actually know that there is an active account with Jornaya and Active Prospect, and they are maintaining, Jornaya and Active Prospect are maintaining those records so that they can be pulled out if you need those as evidence, or at least so that you can do some type of auditing for, you know, regulatory compliance occasionally to make sure things are as they have been represented. So, I mean, just problems out there, you know, money gets involved, and unfortunately some bad actors get greedy and do some bad things.
I may have to reach out to Jornaya and Active Prospect and ask for some sponsorship for today. I didn't know we'd talk about them. I've worked with extensively with Jornaya over the years, and, you know, have to agree with you. Having their product as a compliance tool is very effective. While I have not worked directly with Active Prospect, I do know the owner of the company, and again, another wonderful product as well. Gosh, there's so many things I want to talk to you about. Let's focus on the institutions for a minute. We talked about institutions having direct agreements or contracts, either directly with a lead generator or with an agency that manages those relationships for them. What are some, I guess, best practices or suggestions that you would have from your practice about how institutions can be making sure that the work that they're asking the lead generators to do is getting done A, correctly, and B, in a compliant manner? We talked about Jornaya, we talked about Active Prospect, but what types of things, if you're thinking about, you know, I feel like this is one of those things where I'm going to ask you a question I know the answer to, but I'm going to ask anyway. What are some things that institutions can do in their contractual agreements or in their meetings with their vendors? Because at the end of the day, as we're going to talk about, you know, they're the ones likely to be the subject of regulatory investigations, of any potential lawsuits. And I also wanted to throw out, which doesn't come up enough in these conversations, is that any institution that participates in Title IV funding, their program participation agreement, which is their contract with the federal government to receive Title IV funds, has a requirement in there that they refrain from engaging in any substantial misrepresentation. And that applies to them and those people that help them with their marketing efforts. So that's another risk in addition to regulatory investigations and lawsuits. So I'm an institution. What am I supposed to be doing to make sure that my vendors are doing these things correctly?
You must have a vendor due diligence program. It's not an option not to anymore, because you and I could list dozens of laws that have liability in them for the seller who retains a marketer that doesn't follow the law. And so, you know, that due diligence program can come in a lot of different flavors. They're always company specific. I think I've done hundreds of them in my career. But, you know, at a minimum, they have to have mandatory contract provisions in them that dictate exactly what the vendors can and cannot do when they are marketing on behalf of the institution. They have to be very specific about what the lead generation requirements are and what can and cannot be represented in any of those websites or other advertisements that they might use. And then it also must be very specific about how they can and cannot use publishers and that those publishers be disclosed. And you always get pushback on this because the lead generator thinks if you know who their publishers are, then you'll skip the lead generator for getting for business. You'll go straight to the publisher. And that does not happen as frequently as I think most lead generators are concerned about. But you know, that due diligence program has to set out all of those types of things. It has to be in the contract. And then the best programs I have seen have relied on some type of third-party auditing with their marketing partners, their lead generators, so that the things that are being represented can be documented and validated. And PACE, I was general counsel for PACE for, gosh, 13 years and maybe going on 14 years, just until this last June, but still very active with PACE. And they have a self-regulatory organization. And a lot of big companies have used the self-regulatory organization as a third-party auditing service to go in and look at these marketing partners to see if they are doing those types of things that they're contractually obligated to do. And by having that, you eliminate a huge amount of the risk because the risk is based on a set of facts that show that you knew or should have known that your marketing partners were violating the law. And so when you have these third party auditing services that give a, well, either they're going to give stamp of approval basically, or they're not. And if they're not, you want to get rid of that, that marketing partner. But if they do, that is really weighty evidence that for years I have talked to the FTC, the FCC, the AGs about, and you know, they find that as something that is sturdy and valid and shows that you did your due diligence. And so that is very effective at breaking that chain. If you get a due diligence program together, you have the right contractual provisions, and then you do monitoring and auditing to make sure they're actually doing what they're required to do. And the big thing is you usually don't have to use that process as a defense in litigation or regulatory action, because if you're doing those things, you're not going to run into issues. So it's a belt and suspender approach for sure that is very effective.
I'm smiling because I think in my first episode, I mentioned that higher education is just filled with acronyms. We have acronyms for everything. So now yeah. I heard you rattle off our federal agency acronyms. So I'm laughing. So I think your point is well taken and bears repeating, which is it's not only being wise enough to have the right contractual provisions, it's ensuring that you do your due diligence when you start, while you're doing it, and that you have a monitoring and audit system in place so that you know that the things you agreed to with your vendors are actually getting done and they're getting done. And I'm not sure that institutions always get to that third monitoring and auditing piece.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's really not rocket science. It's not difficult. I know in a lot of the areas of the law, and with higher education in particular, I can think of some areas probably around privacy that they're doing these types of things. And so this process is something that should not be unfamiliar to the EDU space because they're doing it in other areas. I just think that when it comes to marketing, it's something they haven't thought as much about. Some have not thought as much about to ensure that they're getting those same what I call the ability to sleep easy at night that you get from doing these types of things. You know, when you get through these audits, you feel much better. And so, you know, if they look to the other practices that they're using, and I would say it's primarily around privacy issues for them, it's really easy to apply that in the marketing area as well.
And I think to those people that are listening that are thinking, wow, this sounds like a really great idea. I don't have this. And I generally only reach out to lawyers when I get sued. If to those that have an in-house legal team, you should be leveraging them. But it sounds like, and I think you mentioned this earlier, that, you know, this is something that you do with clients. You help them build out these programs. Because I could imagine if you're just listening to this, it might sound fairly overwhelming. Where do I start? Does my contract look good? Do I have the right provisions? But this seems like one of those. And I know you and I have both spoken many, many conferences where we've sort of advocated this, which is, you know, this is one area where, you know, being penny wise and pound foolish really doesn't make any sense. And that, you know, turning to outside counsel, someone like yourself, to sort of help build those kind of programs.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think they would be surprised at the affordability of these types of programs when you work with firms, or sometimes it's not even law firms. There are other companies out there that are not law firms that do this, but that, you know, do this type of thing on a regular basis, because we're not reinventing the wheel. We already have all of our tools and our processes, and very comfortable with asking for the right type of information from the client from the get-go, and then working with the vendors in a way that makes sense. So, yeah.
I want to be respectful of your time. I know we only have a few minutes left. So one of the things I'm going to say is that you and I are absolutely up for a part two. The question is just in the last few minutes that we have until I know you have to go. What do you think could be the next topic that we should cover in the time that you have left? Because I'm definitely bringing you back in a week or two, because I've got so many things I want to ask you.
Yes. Yes. And you know what? There'll be so many updates in a week or two to talk about. You know, if we were just giving what are the hot topics right now, and we could preview what we'll talk about.
That would be
next
great.
Time.
Let's do a preview so everyone comes back and listens again.
That's right. This is our trailer for episode two.
There you go.
So the Federal Trade Commission, I'm going to stop using the acronyms. Thank you for reminding me. Along with the state attorneys general, all 50 of them, and actually 51 because the District of Columbia was involved in too, just had a massive, what they call sweep, that took place last month. And it was called Stop Scam Calls. And the whole point that these regulators were making with this enforcement action is what type of consent is required for what they'll call robocalls. And we'll talk about what a robocall is next time also, because it means different things to different agencies, but basically pre-recorded or automated telephone calls. And there was some kind of earth-shattering news there for lead generators, when the FTC said you had to get consent directly from a consumer to one seller. So we can talk about what that means, consent to make follow-up pre-recorded message calls to consumers. So really a big issue. And then also the Federal Communications Commission has a rulemaking in progress that the industry has commented on. I think that ended in June. The last comments were submitted. Where the FCC is looking at what they call closing the lead generator loophole. And so they're looking at what the definition of prior express consent should mean. And I'll tell you that they're looking at making all consent forms be logically and topically related to the website. And they are also putting out there the idea of being required to have a consumer directly consent to a single seller, as opposed to being able to get consent for maybe, let's say, 10 universities at the same time, because we don't know which university would be the best fit for a potential student. And so we can talk about ways to prepare for that, and also some recommendations for what to be talking about with your lead generators about right now. And then lastly, the last thing we think we would talk about would be the FCC and what they're doing with telephone carriers. And so telephone carriers for the EDUs are making it more difficult to get marketing calls out. We should talk about what that means and how to avoid having calls blocked by the carriers, or potentially being identified as a unreliable carrier or call originator. That would be a significant issue with the FCC. So we can definitely talk 45 minutes about those three topics.
That was a fabulous teaser. So I am going to end this episode by thanking you so much for coming on and telling everyone, please stay tuned. Michelle and I will be back with part two just as soon as we can get it scheduled. So thank you.
Thank you.
Again, thank you.